From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Greece has accused its EU and IMF creditors of trying to pressure Athens to cut pensions and raise sales taxes. Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras said Athens will wait until its creditors are more realistic. He made the remarks a day after last-ditch attempts at talks collapsed, raising fears that Greece would soon exit the eurozone. After the failure of the talks, the Athens stock market dropped more than 6%, and European markets lost more than 1%. Press TV's Konstantin Venizelos filed this report from Athens.
The Greek Prime Minister remains adamant about the call of Syriza's manifesto pre- and post-electorally. Basically, in a nutshell, Greece's new leftist government will not be forced into legislating deeper VAT, pension and wage hikes, which is what the country's lenders want to see the government doing to unlock the financial aid. The country's lenders want Tsipras to legislate 2 billion euros worth of austerity cuts every year for the next 2 or 3 years. And this is something that the government here is simply refusing to do. So far, the country's government has met the Troikan demands more than halfway. They have so far agreed to the privatizations of state companies and enterprises. They have agreed to partial VAT and taxation increases in specific zones in the country. For example, tourist zones where tax evasion is mostly observed. But they will not go into passing, voting into parliament, that is, axing wages and pension any further than they have already been slashed over the last 5 years with all the previous governments, pro-austerity governments. So yes, this is a crunch week for Greece, and tension is now rapidly shifting onto this Thursday's make or break Eurogroup, which is broadly viewed as Greece's last chance to strike a deal, although it's not and will be not as easy as mainstream news outlets believe to force Greece into a disorderly default. Greece has already defaulted on its IMF June repayments so far. It is promising to bundle these payments up for the end of the month, but if it doesn't receive any financial aid from the ECB or the lenders, then Greece will not be able to make those repayments. However, Greece to default, Christine Lagarde, the IMF chief, has to send a refusal of pay letter to the board of executives, and that will take another few weeks, perhaps a month, to approve, finalize, and finally officiate this order of default. So basically, Greece will not default unless the IMF says it has defaulted. And for that eventuality to actually become a reality here in Greece, it needs another 2 months, maybe. So June, but I think Greece will not be defaulting by the end of the month, as some want to see happen. There is still some room for negotiations, I think. But I think that the choices for Tsipras now are very clear. Tsipras will either have to stick to its pre-electoral mandate and protect wages and pensions, or follow this, as prompted by the Syriza hardliners, to its logical conclusion and opt out of the eurozone entirely. But I think the tactic here with Syriza is to buy as much time as possible until the Spanish elections. Last week, Madrid and Barcelona elected far leftist female mayors. So all the indication in the world points to radical political change coming up in Spain this September with the national elections there. So if Syriza can gain a solid ally in its anti-austerity struggle, then it will turn things to its favor. But for the time being, the pressure is on. The Bundesbank chief this afternoon says time is running out for Greece. All the European officials are attacking Tsipras and the government here. So we'll have to see how Thursday plays out. This is perhaps the most important Eurogroup coming up after the February 20th Eurogroup.
Another round of talks will take place Thursday.
As you know, our goal was to have a joint meeting this morning, but logistical issues made this impossible This morning.
That was UN Secretary Ban Ki-moon Monday explaining the delay in the start of peace talks scheduled for Monday that are aimed at a ceasefire in Yemen.
But I'm pleased to note that the other parties are on their way, and the full complement of participants in the consultations should be here in the coming hours.
The Secretary General laid out the consequences of failure that are facing the people of Yemen from fighting that has plagued the country since March of this year.
We have a special obligation to act. Even before the terrible fighting, Yemen was one of the world's poorest countries in one of the world's richest neighborhoods. Today, Yemen's very existence hangs in the balance. While parties bicker, Yemen burns.
But he failed to mention the fact that the bulk of the casualties were caused by Saudi Arabia's air campaign, which began in late March and has continued daily to target civilian population centers. He was called on that by one reporter during the Q&A, but declined to directly answer the question.
I'm urging them that particularly during this Ramadan, which is a period for peace for people and pray for peace, they must stop. And I'm urging again the parties to have humanitarian pause so that this can create some political space. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay. Shukran. Okay.
Meanwhile, some reports indicated that the Yemeni delegation's transportation problems were not just a matter of scheduling airline flights. Press TV's Waqar Rizvi spoke with Hamid Riza Imadi about that.
Mr. Imadi, thanks for joining us. Now, you know, the Ansarullah movement has not yet been able to join these Geneva talks. What do you make of that?
Well, I've heard that the plane is set to take off today, but the Ansarullah delegation, as you said, was supposed to travel to Geneva. But some sources say that the Saudis have put pressure on Egypt not to let the plane carrying the Ansarullah delegation and their allies use the Egyptian airspace. If that's confirmed, that could amount to state terrorism by Saudi Arabia. Why should Saudi Arabia prevent the most important party to international negotiations over Yemen from attending the event? Let's hope the Saudi rulers come to their senses, stop the bombing of civilians, and let diplomacy replace violence in Yemen. On the other hand, the United Nations needs to do more. Ban Ki-moon, that we just saw in pictures, who is perhaps the weakest UN Secretary General ever, has not been able to stop the Saudi regime's killing of women and children in Yemen. This calls into question the very notion of having an organization called the United Nations and its Security Council that's proved to be extremely politicized.
And do you think that the violence would continue unabated, or will the Saudis stop these killings if these Geneva talks bear any fruit?
Well, the Ansarullah movement has become very popular in Yemen these days. Some statistics say that over 80% of Yemenis approve of Ansarullah's performance. The movement also controls large parts of the country now and has shown efficiency in governing those areas. On the other hand, the Saudi-backed Hadi regime has not yet been able to return to power, and is not supposed to return to power given the circumstances that we see right now on the ground, the situation. After 2 months of Saudi bombardments, the Hadi regime has not been able to do anything. As we speak, the Ansarullah movement has the upper hand in negotiations, if they're allowed to participate in the talks, of course. The Saudis have no other option than stop the violence, let diplomats do their job, and we have to take into consideration that some 80% of the people of Yemen are in a very critical humanitarian situation, and a human catastrophe is in the making there. The Saudis will have to sit down and accept a Yemeni solution to the crisis. That's the only solution.
Tens of thousands of protesters surrounded the National Diet building in Tokyo Sunday to express strong opposition to Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's efforts to ram through a series of military-related bills. The protesters said Abe would drag Japan into a war again if those bills are passed. Opposition party leaders joined the protesters, with Social Democratic Party chief Tadatomo Yoshida criticizing Abe for promising to seek passage of the bills while on his latest visit to Washington. Sunday's protest followed a similar one in Tokyo Saturday that also drew tens of thousands. Many political heavyweights in Japan have spoken against the proposed legislation, including former Finance Minister Hirohisa Fuji.
The right of collective self-defense proposed by the Liberal Democratic Party and Cold NATO Party is a kind of cheating. What is the right of collective self-defense? It is a kind of military alliance. If Japan really does this, the country will be going the wrong way.
Masayoshi Takamura served as chief cabinet secretary for the government of Morihiro Hosokawa in 1994 and as finance minister in the cabinet led by Prime Minister Tomiichi Moriyama until 1996. He said that what Abe was doing would likely get Japan into a war.
I think Abe wants to fundamentally change the pacifism which has lasted for nearly 70 years in Japan. Japan was not allowed to use military forces overseas, but Abe wants to make Japan capable of using military forces. Thus, it becomes much more likely that Japan will be dragged into overseas wars.
Although the protests saw more than 25,000 people crowd outside Japan's parliament Sunday, there was almost no coverage of it in Japanese media outlets like NHK World Monday morning, whose website instead hosted a piece about a peace conference being held in Tokyo this coming Saturday.
Japanese government officials are getting ready to welcome delegates from across Asia to share their views on lessons learned in the region.
The lesson Japan learned from World War II was expressed in Article 9 of its post-war constitution, which prohibits the country from engaging in war. That provision has been slowly eroded with the active encouragement of the U.S. over the years. The most recent actions by the government, however, according to most observers, will essentially constitute an abrogation of that restriction. As we reported previously, China's senior military official visited the U.S. last week. General Fan Changlong, vice chair of China's Central Military Commission, began an official visit to Cuba Saturday. CCTV's Michael Voss filed this report from Havana.
General Fan's U.S. trip included talks at the Pentagon with the U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter, as well as visits to army bases and an aircraft carrier. It was seen as an important trip to improve communication between the world's two largest economies amid heightened tensions between China and the U.S. over the South China Sea. His visit to Cuba is the latest in what are regular, high-level exchanges between senior Cuban and Chinese military officials. Last year, the chief of China's general staff, General Fang Fenghui, was here. Cuba's armed forces rely heavily on old Soviet-era equipment, much of it in need of repair and spare parts. The Chinese military has similar hardware, and Cuba is looking to Beijing for assistance in maintaining its defense capabilities. But supplying Cuba is proving problematic, particularly with the U.S. arms embargo still in place. In February, Colombia detained a Chinese ship bound for Cuba carrying shell casings and explosives, listed on the ship's manifest as grain. China denied any wrongdoing, saying the ship was transporting regular military supplies to Cuba and that it had not violated any international norms. The ship was eventually allowed to sail on to Cuba, but the captain was detained. Now, these military visits are very much of a two-way process. Many of Cuba's top brass have also been to Beijing in recent years, and 3 years ago there, they did agree to an enhanced military cooperation agreement, which includes more personnel training and also a cooperation in other areas. Michael Voss, CCTV, Havana.
Almost daily, world news reports include coverage of yet another trade deal involving China that illustrates the Asian giant's rise to the top of the world's economies. But China's real potential as a foil to U.S. aspirations for global hegemony lies in the so-called New Silk Road. Eric Dreitzer hosts Counterpunch Radio at counterpunch.org. He spoke with journalist Pepe Escobar of the Asia Times about China's development and especially its look westward for continued economic growth.
I know that you follow a lot of the mainstream presses as I do, and I mean, it seems almost like every week we have an op-ed or a cover story in the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times or the New York Times basically saying, well, the Chinese economy will collapse tomorrow, the Chinese Communist Party is facing internal contradictions and it could collapse next week. You know, you hear a lot of doomsday scenarios about China and, you know, know, the potential stock bubble and all of the rest of this stuff. And yet Xi Jinping seems to kind of more or less have things in hand, at least to a large extent. And I don't really buy into a lot of this propaganda about the instability of China, either economically or politically.
You're absolutely right, Eric. You just need to spend a few weeks in China to see for yourself, you know. And the way they are tweaking the model, it's like landing an Airbus in a jungle, in fact. And they're doing it little by little. The new urbanization drive, for instance. Of course, there will be a lot of corruption. There will be a lot of misinvestment, like building ghost cities in Gansu province or Xinjiang, and nobody will come, you know, of course. But at the same time, they will build functional cities, mid-sized cities in important provinces in the center, for instance. I wouldn't say Tibet or Xinjiang. It's much more complicated to draw people from the eastern seaboard to work in western China. Of course, you need a lot of carrots to do that. It works. Especially with people that are not extremely skilled. Skilled workers, they prefer to stay in the eastern seaboard, or if they go to the center, they go to Sichuan province, which is booming like crazy. Mm-hmm. Chengdu, Chongqing, you know, these places. And long term, the new urbanization drive in until 2000, and they have projections until 2020, 2025, they plan to bring from 150 million to 300 million people from the countryside in all provinces to these big cities, urbanize the country. And China is already 50-51% an urban society, will be 70% urban by 2025. This is an amazing feat. Obviously, it has to be centrally controlled. The directives are there. It means all the provinces and the provincial governors, they have to work very closely. And of course, they have to rein in speculators in the real estate market. It's so complex, but it's beginning to work a little bit. You see, there are some ghost cities. I hadn't had the chance to go to Xinjiang this time. There are some ghost cities in Xinjiang, but there are some new sort of model suburban cities springing mm-hmm. up everywhere in central and eastern China as well. This is what they want, essentially. They have their go west policy, which is to, let's say, colonize Tibet and Xinjiang. But it's a desert and a Himalayan plateau, essentially. You cannot put 100 million people in the desert or in the Himalayan plateau. But you can have, for instance, hubs like Urumqi, the capital of Xinjiang, which is they're turning Urumqi. Many people don't know they're turning Urumqi into the high tech hub, because it's going to be a very important hub in the New Silk Road.
Yes,
but everything coming from the east in the terrestrial New Silk Road, starting in Shanghai and Xi'an, going all the way Gansu province and Xinjiang, the hub is Urumqi, and from Urumqi it goes all over the place. It goes to Kazakhstan, it goes to other parts of Central Asia, it goes south to Pakistan, the famous China-Pakistan economic corridor. So Urumqi, which until 10, 15 years ago was just a big Chinese-style, Eastern Chinese-style city in the middle of the desert, now it's that with the suburbs and a high-tech hub at the same time. People would not even think about 10 years ago.
And you're seeing an influx of a lot of engineering types and other types who are going to be in Urumqi to design this massive airport they're talking about, because when they're saying a hub, they're talking about a rail hub, and you see that in regards to this this new deal between this this freight corridor that's going to run Urumqi to Moscow. You have this airport they're talking about, the major, of course, pipeline issues, you know, the Russian Russians and the Chinese are talking about dual pipelines, both in the east and the west. You have an Altai pipeline. Urumqi is going to be one of the central hubs of that. Urumqi is also, in many ways, the center of a lot of the trade that the Chinese envision coming out of Pakistan's Gwadar port, which the Chinese are major investors and controllers of. So all of that trade coming out of the Indian Ocean is not only going to go to the east coast of China, it's going to go north to Urumqi. So in many ways, Xinjiang figures centrally in all of China's Silk Road plans, not just in terms of the land-based Silk Road.
You're absolutely right. Very well put, Eric, in fact. You managed to put the whole thing in 2 minutes. Congratulations.
I'll await my award and medal in the mail. But, you know, I think that there's so many angles to this, of course, because there's also this simultaneous development that we've seen. I know I've written about it. You've written about it. The Eurasian Economic Union, which the Russians have pushed very strongly, and Kazakhstan figures central in that. And Kazakhstan, geographically, and anybody who knows geopolitics, the importance of geography here, Kazakhstan also plays a central role in all of this. So when you're looking at these, as you've coined the term, pipelineistan issues, Kazakhstan, the Eurasian Economic Union, all of this Central Asian activity is really centered around Western China. And that's why it's so important.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating how American corporate media, they completely bypassed that.
Yep.
This happened, a few weeks ago, in fact. I had written about it before and said, look, this is going to happen. The merge of the New Silk Road Strategy and the Eurasian Economic Union. Mm-hmm. But this was inevitable because they are complementary and they involve some of the same players are part of both strategies. And Kazakhstan, as you said, is absolutely essential. It's essential for China as traversing Kazakhstan across Central Asia going west, and because Kazakhstan, oil and gas especially. So for China, this is a matter of national interest, national security as well. And Kazakhstan, they look at the Chinese market, obviously, you know, for them is absolutely perfect. Central Asia, Kazakhstan is not only the most important, there's also, don't forget, Turkmenistan as well. The new Silk Road across Central Asia will go across Turkmenistan, which is already linked to China by a pipeline that Chinese themselves built. Mm-hmm. And Iran. Iran and Turkmenistan, they have swapped deals with gas, and Iran is an essential hub of the Central Silk Road. And then immediately to the west, there's what? Turkey. So, you know, the new Silk Roads across Central Asia, the hubs are going to be Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, across Iran, and finishing in Istanbul. All these countries are on board. Turkey is on board. Iran don't even mention, you know, even with deal or no deal at the end of this month, China and Iran are already trading energy in yuan, by the way, for a while now. Don't forget that the Chinese established a parallel SWIFT mechanism for Iran to be paid in yuan for the gas and the oil that they sell to China. This is going to balloon from now on as well. Same thing between Russia and China is going to be in rubles, in yuan, or both. So all these parallel developments are – no. So you have the confluence of New Silk Roads with the Eurasian Economic Union. You have all these countries starting to trade energy in their own currencies. You have the Eurasian integration – progressively going west and spanning especially the Central Asian landlocked countries. You have Iran incorporated into, I would say, the Russian-Chinese push towards integration in across Eurasia. And you have Turkey, who just made the Turk Stream deal with Russia. Mm-hmm. It's also complementary. I would say advertised in the West, a rift between Turkey and Iran. No, this is all also ridiculous because Turkey, they need Iran in terms of energy provider. They want to be the hub for Iranian energy going west. to Europe. And at the same time, they buy most of their energy from Russia. So for Turkey, you know, this quadrangular relationship with Russia, China, and Iran is absolutely essential as well. Now, their only problem, of course, is what Erdogan's problem with Syria, but that's another conversation.
Well, and actually, it absolutely is. And on the other side of the break, I want to talk a little bit about Turkey because, you know, this sort of concept of multi-vector strategy that Kazakhstan has long since employed, Turkey is employing in so many different ways. It's insane. But let's come back to that. But before we go to the break, I just want to mention one other piece to this Pipelinistan question that I know you've talked about a lot that I think is under the radar for a lot of people, and often I think that that's a mistake, and that is the development of the Iran-Pakistan pipeline, which has been proposed now literally for decades. It's been on again, off again, scrapped, restarted, but I think that the Iranian side of that pipeline is essentially already built. The question of financing the Pakistani side has always been an issue. Terrorism-related issues in Balochistan have been a major problem of that. But ultimately, I think that the Chinese envisioned that as part of this strategy. And actually, I think a major part of it, because if you have an Iran-Pakistan pipeline, there's very little that's really stopping it from becoming an Iran-Pakistan-China pipeline. And once it goes through that Khyber Pass, once it becomes an Iran-Pakistan-China pipeline, and you have a direct energy link between Iran and China, I think that that really changes the entire geopolitical game for China as far as all of these Silk Road strategies.
Absolutely, Eric. This is absolutely, the IP is an absolutely essential story. I've been following this story for years. I wrote a lot about it. It's a goal on both sides now. The Iranian stretch is already built.
Yep.
The Pakistanis didn't have money to build their own stretch. The Iranians volunteered to finance part of it. This went nowhere until the Chinese stepped in a few weeks, two or three months ago, and they said, no, we will build it, we will finance it. Obviously, because they are thinking, obviously, like all things Chinese, they are thinking ahead 20, 30 years, which is what? An extension of the IP from Gwadar all the way to Xinjiang.
Exactly.
Once again, the hub. So don't forget that this will be parallel to the Karakoram Highway, which is one of my favorite roads in the world, in fact. It's fascinating because don't forget that Karakoram Highway was built by Chinese engineers side by side with Pakistani engineers. It's fascinating. You know, they're blasting tunnels at 3,000 meter high. It's completely, it's one of the most fascinating engineering feats anywhere in the world. So for them to build a pipeline, parallel to the Karakoram Highway, the Chinese can do that in what, 4 or 5 years. And in fact, the fact that the Chinese are mastering new technologies so well nowadays, Chinese construction companies, they're building stuff all over the, you know, the road that they build from Gansu province to Tibet in the Himalaya plateau, 4,500 meter high. It's an engineering feat of the absolute magnitude, in fact. So for these construction companies, there are no challenges anymore. So we have IP, which will, in terms of an umbilical cord between Iran and Pakistan, is essential for Pakistan. It is essential for both, in fact. There won't be any more animosity between them because they are linked by energy directly. And, of course, for the Chinese, they can use Gwadar as a port as well for their own energy needs. And long-term, once again, the pipeline from Gwadar to Xinjiang. So it's, as they say in China, a win-win situation. It's a three-win situation for Iran, for Pakistan, and for China at the same time.
And if there is a pipeline link between Pakistan and China, then a direct link between Iran and China would likely be next. And that could be a geopolitical game changer. More on that tomorrow. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.